Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy August weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every Friday. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days as a warm ear hug for you. On this week's episode, Amanda Brunker reviews Kneecap the movie, Donal Ryan talks about Tip, and Kelly Harrington's brother reacts to his little sister's gold medal double Olympic champion triumph. Our first chat on the podcast is with journalist, playwright, mammy about town, Amanda Brunker, who was our visiting critic this week, and she went to the premiere of Kneecap. The sensational Belfast-set comedy musical film is out now in cinemas. She wouldn't be mad about hip-hop and rapping, so this is well outside her comfort zone, and she told us why she thinks this needs to win an Oscar. So she reviews the film and she tells us what it was like watching it sitting next to Pat Kenny, Stephen Ray and Liam Cunningham. Can you imagine Pat Kenny watching a film where someone bares their backside with the words "Brits out" written right across their cheeks? That's the vibe that Amanda Brunker brought to studio. After that, we go to a different tone. Donal Ryan, he was our guest in studio. He was talking about his brand new novel, Heart Be at Peace, which is set along his Tipperary hinterland home places. And he also told us about losing his mum recently, watching drug deals happen in supermarket car parks of rural Ireland, and what his teenage kids think about having a dad whose work is on the Leaving Cert. They are morto. Just a little bit of a spoiler there. And at the end, we had a gorgeous conversation with Christopher Harrington, Kelly Harrington's brother. He was live from Paris on the morning after that major fight when she defended successfully her Olympic boxing gold medal and erupted such joy right across the nation. Christopher really impressed all of our listeners. Kind of a deeply emotional response to the moment and what it means to him and his family. He did a lovely tribute as well to Kelly and his parents and the local people of Portland Row in Dublin's inner city. So that's everything in the podcast. Next Monday, I'll be back on the wireless, RTE Radio 1, 9 till 10 every weekday. But in the meantime, we'll just start the weekend podcast. Enjoy. This week's visiting critic is writer, playwright, journalist, Mammy About Town, I described you as.
Mammy About Town, I love that.
You like it, okay, thank you.
I am
Amanda
a Mammy About Town.
Brunker, good morning, Amanda.
Dia gweta cordia. Cwrs a ta tu.
Tommy, anna gomaha ar ffad agus nil gael gael leif o gom sa ta bron
Oh, well, me neither.
Fresh, okay.
I'm trying though, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's making an effort.
So
just
the Kneecap film is making you feel the graw.
Well, actually, I did. Some of your listeners would have seen it because it was a gorgeous little show, Reality na Gaeltachta. And it was so popular,
yes,
they replayed it three times. Mm-hmm. So we started off on RT1 at 5:30, then they replayed it on RT2 at whatever time. Yeah, exactly. Gormil Mokot. And then it went to RT1 earlier this year at 8 o'clock. So we were prime time, baby.
Oh my goodness, Eanthus.
I just wish they'd do it again though. And I don't get any more money for the one show.
Des was on that, wasn't he?
He was great.
Cottage Air into Coleslaw as Gooligoo.
I've never actually met somebody who could talk as much as Des.
Yeah.
He was honestly, it was like, Des, just switch it off a little
he
bit.
Stop.
You'd be filming all day and like they'd be long days. And I'm not giving out, but he could spin a yarn and he could be telling that yarn from 8 a.m.
Actually, even just doing Des, I suddenly feel very relaxed. You know, just.
But he speaks a tiny bit faster.
Does he? Right, take your word for it. Right, totally.
But the gas thing is, the day that we were actually going up to Donegal, sorry, I digress.
Yeah.
But the day
this
we were going up to Donegal to film up in Ranafast, which is the Gaeltacht area up in Donegal,
yeah.
And beautiful. But there was a problem with the booking, whatever, tech. So we were there for 4 hours. It was so hot. And we were standing outside Dublin Airport for 4 hours. I had heard everybody's life story before we'd even got up to Donegal.
Flew in.
And after 4 hours, I had to say to the producer, I said, I am just going to drive myself up to Donegal. And she said, oh, no, you can't do that. We all have to stay together. We have to stay together. I said, I cannot listen to any more stories. I need to be on my own.
The most beautiful, one of the most beautiful airports in the world to land in.
It was voted the most beautiful in Europe to land
there
in.
Yeah.
In Ranafast.
It's stunning.
It is beautiful. No, but I've never seen a place that has so many lakes beside the sea. Like, it will be the first place to sink. It actually will, 100%.
Don't say that.
It will disappear.
The cliffs are high.
You should go.
How do you get on with
soon.
The Donegal Irish, by the way? Because they do things differently up
it's
beyond.
It's difficult.
Because they say, like, crook instead of knock and things
well,
like that.
Well, I only had kind of little bits of Irish from school, and I haven't been to school for a very long time, but it was very different to their Irish, so I was totally lost.
Yes,
but they were so kind. But by the end of the week of filming, my conversational Irish was really good, and then I came back and I was like, oh, do you quit the la la la, get thrown out all the words, and everybody just laughed at me, and within a couple of weeks I just stopped.
Your confidence went.
So the only thing I can do, I do now, is I still say slán and gormil mhogat and things like that.
That's gone. It's enough to keep a well, it keeps
pretend
in the back of your head,
that
I'm
Irish.
It? Yeah.
It is embarrassing, though, isn't
ta
it?
Ta too, isn't it? Don't you go like ta?
But that's what this movie that I'm in to talk about, which
yes,
I would
sorry,
have never
just remembered now.
Watched. Why am I here again?
you're the visiting critic, and you went to the premiere of this.
I did. Now, this is a film I never would have gone to see.
Why is that now?
I'm more of a bridesmaid than a godfather. You know, if it was TV, give me Golden Girls over The Sopranos. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I just want light. Life is hard. It's difficult. I just want a few giggles. I just want easy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I never would have seen this, even though people would have said, it's a great movie, go see it. But I was there at the premiere and it was very random. Like, they pull up in like a, you know, one of those Defender Jeeps.
Oh, they make some entry, don't they?
And they're flying like Palestinian and Irish flags, and it's like one lad's wearing a tricolour balaclava, you know, and it's like
right,
the
yeah.
middle-aged mammy about town in me is kind of going, oh, jeez, oh, jeez. What's all this about? Now, obviously, there's no point in me painting myself as some really prudish old one. I'm not quite that bad.
No.
You know, in my head, I'm still a young one at 25, even though the body hurts quite a lot. And I look in the
you
mirror.
You look amazing.
And go,
you look
who incredible. Is that person in the mirror? Like, I don't do it anymore. It's too upsetting. But in fairness, I was listening to your intro before I came in.
Oh, yeah.
You gave a huge amount of detail about the film before
oh,
I came
I?
In. Do we have anything left to talk about?
I didn't think I gave much away at all. I mean, because I read so huge plot lines in other reviews.
You're very organised.
That I left out.
I'm very impressed,
we're up,
Oliver.
We're up early. We're up early doing this.
So professional. So professional.
Did they have flares? Because in Belfast, they arrived with green flares off the sitting on the top of the Defender.
I'd say they just forgot the flares. I'd say
this is Dublin. It's like this doesn't really work.
But it was so funny. Somebody nearly got arrested because when the Jeep arrived up, some fella came along and tried to get into the back of the Jeep. And the guards actually, yeah, my husband videoed.
It's a good film premiere when someone's been arrested. Isn't
somebody's
it?
Trying to nick something out of the back
That's
of the
exactly.
Jeep.
Yeah,
no, it was actually lovely because there was a huge demand that they had to put it on in two cinemas.
Wow.
So many people, you know, IFTA members, which I am, that's why I was invited. And there was...
Oh, you're a member of IFTA. It's the Academy of Film
Listen,
and Television.
Anybody could be a member of IFTA. You just have to pay a few quid.
Oh, right. OK. It's worth it on Twitter now.
I'm trying to support the arts here, Oliver.
Yeah.
Trying to support the arts.
Two screens. Very unusual. In Belfast, I believe there was eight screens.
Eight, yeah.
That's unbelievable.
So now, God love the poor lads because their Belfast premiere was on the night before the Irish one. So they were a little bit tired and emotional, as some people would say.
Very good, yeah. I'd love that phrase still there.
So I'd say they no more wanted to be there. And of course, all the Dublin heads kind of fawning over them. And they were just like, oh, God, I'm exhausted. But they were lovely.
They're absolutely lovely. They're bundles of energy. And by the way, they do incredible live shows.
Well, there's a great clip on TikTok. I love TikTok. Have you got onto TikTok?
Yeah, not much. Not, yeah.
You need to start following me. I've only started.
We'll do something together after.
I've started a thing on TikTok. Oh, I don't know how to do the funny TikToks. I only know how to talk into it. I've started doing excerpts of my naughty books, reading them. So you have to follow me. Follow
well,
me on TikTok.
That's very TikTokable.
I've only got 115 followers.
If you've just joined us, this is an Amanda Brunker stream of consciousness. Okay, back on track. Do you know what will bring
track.
Us back on track?
Tell
if we
us.
Play a clip of the trailer, how about that?
Oh, go on.
This is the this
that's
is
a bit dangerous. Could you find one that's
is it
clean enough?
Kneecap trailer clip. Is that the right one? I've forgotten already which one I played. That's the one. Okay, here it is. Here it is. This is the boys who go in to meet social services and so on, and they're looking, I think, for over-the-counter drugs kind of thing.
You've heard of intergenerational trauma, right?
Right.
Our history?
Our history has become our biology. It's like the trauma our ancestors suffered.
Has inserted itself?
Has actually inserted itself into our genetic code. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Psychological reverberations.
ADHD. ODD.
The troubles?
I've got troubles.
They've all got troubles.
I mean, it's funny.
Will you describe this as kind of like an 8 Mile? It's more of a train spotting.
Is it?
More of a train spot. Like it is, if you're a bit squeamish about any sexual content and any kind of drug taking or anything like
that.
It's not for you.
And it's 16s, no kids.
Is it 16?
Yeah, 16.
I'm surprised it's not more.
Really? The film, you know, classification is...
And also, if you have a problem with seeing a bare buttocks with the words Brits out across and blazoned across the backside, it's not the film for you. It was actually very funny. I was kind of sitting close to Pat Kenny and I was trying to watch his facial expressions. Sorry, that's Gable.
Was at it.
He was way past his bedtime.
I don't be saying that. No.
It was way past my bedtime.
I'm not going to hear it anyway.
It is. I have to say, I actually cried at the end of this. Well,
get away.
Listen, I'm a menopausal woman. What could I say? It doesn't take much to.
Now, that would be a topic Pat would be very comfortable discussing.
A butter commercial could send me crying. But
Pat is 76 years old, by the way. I've just
Googled
it.
Can I just say, he looks still fabulous.
Unbelievable, isn't he?
And I'll give you a little Pat Kenny trivia. When I was Miss Ireland, right? Now, don't be scared.
We'll come back to the film shortly.
When I was Miss Ireland.
Oh, this sounds good already.
Many, many moons ago.
Yeah.
I was only 17, which is terrible, right?
Really?
I lied. I was Nadine Coyle before she was even thought of.
Right? You had to be 18.
Had to be 18. I said I was 18 and I was only 17. Oh, it was very mortifying.
Who would have thought you were geared for a career in tabloid journalism?
But anyway, I started going out with somebody in RTE. And do you remember back in the day when the Sunday Independent back page, you know, the gossip.
Yeah.
And was huge. You know, if you were mentioned, I can't remember a name off the top of my head. Used to write it?
Keane Edge, are you talking about?
Yes.
Terry Keane, yeah.
So if you were mentioned there, you were big news. But anyway, I was new Miss Ireland. I was dating somebody in RTE and they started speculating on who I was dating or who I was seeing.
Yeah.
And I'm nearly sure Pat was in there. There's a fella called Miles somebody or other. Who was Miles
Duncan.
Miles Duncan. And who else did they say? There was a few other people. I was like,
I thought you were really into kind of academically minded men.
But I was like, I'm nearly sure Pat was married. It was like, they were just speculating on.
There was some brief moments when I was singing them, but I was attractive to the females by the age of 7.
Listen, he's always been a hunk. He's gorgeous. He always has.
Yeah, 5.5 years old. Hunk of the year. But back to kneecap.
The kneecap.
Film. Did you notice any facial expressions from Pat through the film? Did you talk to him?
I think there was a... Listen, he was just doing Blue Steel through the whole thing.
He was so confused. We listened to a trailer there. Is there a story to it?
The story, okay, so it is basically the story, the main story, which has to be told, is the fact that the writer-director, who's actually English, and it is... It's quite funny because like they berate the English the whole time.
In a kind of ironic silly way.
Yeah, so Michael Fassbender, it basically starts off that one of the lads, I think it's Niche, I can't remember, he's...
Mowgli Bap or Mokhara or DJ Provi.
Yeah, no, he's Mowgli Bap. I can't get my tongue around that. I'm too old for that stuff.
Mowgli Bap.
His name is Niche. And the other fella is Lee Moog.
Yeah.
And the other fella is JJ. JJ is the one who's wearing the tricolour.
Oh, right, okay.
And they actually are a teacher. Now, I have to say, I don't think there's much blurred lines of this story and their actual life.
Go away, really?
Yeah, no, it seems to, because it starts off with there's a child being baptised and a helicopter come in the woods.
Okay.
Michael Fassbender's holding the baby and a helicopter comes along, and that actually happened. And Michael Fassbender gives the finger to the helicopter above. Apparently it's some sacred stone or something in the middle of the...
It's like a pagan baptism or something.
But it's all about... He kept repeating the one line of that every Irish word spoken is a bullet for freedom.
Right.
And they basically want, even though this English writer-director... is everything that they should hate throughout the whole movie, because it's Brits out an awful lot.
But there's a reconciliation message eventually.
Oh, there's a huge it's very emotional at the end. And Simone Kirby, right, who's absolutely brilliant,
yeah,
actress.
I love her, yeah.
She is superb. She's been in Peaky Blinders. She does a lot of theatre. She's amazing. She sings at the end, and I actually have goosebumps just thinking about it. It's very poignant. There is a lovely story to it, even though it is, you know, sex, drugs and hip hop, Oscailga, but there's an awful lot more to it. And the mad thing is, you would think that Michael Fassbender is the star of the show. You know, like, he is Hollywood.
A massive, massive star.
And yeah, I don't know how they got him. Like, I mean, it's phenomenal.
I think people would have wanted to get involved afterwards when they've seen it.
Exactly. But it was gas because also Liam Cunningham was sitting there and Stephen Ray was there. And I'm sure they were sitting there going, should have been me.
They all wish they were part of this now because it's so big.
I'm calling this now. This will win an Oscar.
Win an Oscar.
This will win an Oscar. It has been put up as the Irish nomination for best
international feature. Yeah, it used to be called best foreign language film.
Yes.
Now it's
this guy,
the name.
The director, he's actually
the one that
been,
on Colin Kuehn eventually ended up in was shortlisted, nominated. So that's where we.
He's
are.
Also had another short film of his shortlisted for the Academy Awards in 2020. This guy's going far.
Okay,
he's huge.
Very good. And the Americans love this. I mean, I wasn't comparing it to 8 Mile. That was Rolling Stone. Magazine.
Gourmet Le Monde.
But the American press is raging about this. You know raving what? About it.
It won't start. It'll next year when this has Oscar buzz.
Yeah.
This will then get a bigger re-release because it is kind of showing now at the moment, but it's in kind of selected cinemas and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it's getting a multiplex release.
But the one thing
I
will
say
is, it if you are of my kind of era, kind of 50s and whatever, you will actually feel nostalgic for your youth. The music in it, even though, again, the music, not really my kind of thing.
Hip hop and rap.
It's brilliant. It's actually really, really good. And like they kind of sprinkle it then with other music like The Prodigy and stuff like that.
So you are
literally bopping the whole way along. And like, I think there was an awful lot of directors and stuff also at the premiere, and they were all a bit sick. They were like, "I need to go home and start reworking my movie."
Are you serious?
I think it will shake up the Irish film industry. Really, it's going to be huge.
Oh my God,
in cinemas from, I think it was yesterday or today.
It is out yesterday. People are actually texting us in response to it. Kneecap, very smart, funny film. One you would go several times to get a different little jokes that are in there. Makes me hopeful for the future of Von Changa, the Irish language. A lot of drugs, be warned, but if you look beyond that, it is very good. One criticism is it seemed like it was set more in the early 90s, politically speaking, but who am I to know, being a southerner, says Anya in Mayo.
No, definitely not. It's still people. You see, I think people, because it's more quiet now, if you don't actually go up to the north of Ireland, and that's the one thing I learned something new. Every day's a school day, Oliver.
What's that?
They don't want you to say Northern Ireland. It's the north of Ireland.
Oh no.
And you've treaded. I didn't know that.
What? The north.
Yeah, so Northern
of course,
Ireland.
Unionists will insist on Northern Ireland. You understand?
There you go. I learned
and
something
new.
If
you're a Republican, you go, it's the north of Ireland. It's just Ireland, and that's the northern bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thanks a million for jumping into that minefield. Just listening to your Kneecap review, went to see it last night in London. It was a preview event in London. Absolutely brilliant. Like Amanda, I cried at the end.
Yeah.
A bit emotional, says Connor.
It was lovely, actually. Really nice ending. Quite unexpected.
Teresa Dublin says, I love Amanda. What a beautiful speaking voice she has. And a right laugh.
Oh, Gourmet Le Mahogat.
And you look well also.
Considering it's very early. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for breaking your early.
Normally I'm still in my pajamas.
Five-star review for you. Kneecap, out in cinemas, north and south, Northern Ireland and the north of Ireland.
Look
in both
at you.
Places.
Look at you.
Out now, rated 16. Amanda Brunker, thank you so much.
Gourmet Le Mahogat.
Good luck to you, Slán.
Email oliver@rte.ie.
Now, joining me in studio is Donal Ryan. And you know Donal Ryan, his debut novel, The Spinning Heart. You remember that? It was longlisted for the Booker Prize. And it was all about a community in the aftermath of the economic crash and the disaster that happened in 2008. The 21 characters from that book, they wouldn't leave him alone, still going around in his head. So he brought them back for his latest book. And we're glad he has. Heart, Be at Peace is what it's called. Donal, welcome, studio.
Thanks a million, Oliver. It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming up from Limerick.
That's all my pleasure. I'm sorry, no, I know it's a bit of a coming down to come to me from talking about Katie. So apology in advance to your listeners.
But since you are the writer among us and winner of various prizes, is there a way of summing up
up what's happened to Ireland in the last fortnight, or it hasn't even been a fortnight.
I know, it's unbelievable. Like, it's just, I just, that's the beauty of sport. Like, you know, it just, it brings people together. I mean, like, Kelly's victory last night was just one of these huge moments for Ireland, you know, and it's just, everyone just seems so upbeat and positive and happy when these things happen, you know. I mean, she's incredible. Like, she's just, I love her. She's a fantastic person. We met Kelly and Mendy a few years ago at the Irish Book Awards, and they were just so nice and down to earth, just lovely people. And her family, like, to listen to Christopher there was lovely. Like, just seemed like such a decent, hard-working family. Like, the backbone of Ireland, really, people like that.
Yeah, they're incredibly articulate, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
Deep thinking, and they say what's... they're not afraid to show a bit of emotion.
Yeah.
And to be... it's just... it's brilliant people to have around. The people in your book, you're fixated on a certain culture around Tipperary around there. Is there something in the waters there too?
Well, I mean, it's just so familiar. I mean, the language and landscape are so familiar. It's what allowed me to be a writer was the fact that I just decided to write in my own place and in my own voice.
Yeah,
and
good plan.
I mean, all of the people are very familiar. So there was no attempt by me to try to describe something I didn't know about when it came to writing about rural Ireland. But having said that, I mean, very few of the experiences in the book are my experiences. So you're always trying to guess at what it might be like to be somebody else and to experience things that you haven't experienced. But I mean, they feel like friends, and they are all, I mean, a lot of characters I write are composites and distillations of my own experience and the people I love and my friends and family. So there was no huge leap of imagination with the actual place or the people.
Do you have the accent in your head when you're writing?
I do, yeah. I try to get it as right as possible. It's very easy, even though it's my own accent, it's still very easy to tip into caricature and tip into so-called pennywhackery. So you have to be very careful, you know, to get it right, the kind of delocutions and the demotic and the kind of sounds that we make. But I think the way we use English in Ireland is so beautiful, and it's so varied. I mean, from street to street and village to village, things change. There are phrases you won't have heard before, and it's just beautiful.
I nearly wanted to read this book out loud as I was reading it, because it is like a kind of a script. It's inner monologues and the thoughts of people around that area. Can you remind people what The Spinning Heart was about and who the people in it were?
Well, The Spinning Heart was a series of 21 monologues, and all of the people speaking were from the same fictionalised version of my own home place in North Tipperary. And pretty much everybody was affected by the recession. Because I wrote the book in 2010 and it was set in the present day, I couldn't really ignore the recession. So it kind of became a book, you know, a recession book, kind of. And I wasn't crazy about the title, but in fairness, it served the book well.
Why didn't you like the title?
It kind of, because for me, it was a book about people and about, you know, about ordinary Irish rural working class people, like I am myself. And so I didn't really intend it to be a comment on the economy or politics or anything else, because, you know, those things don't occupy me too much. But that's what it became, which is fine, in fairness. I mean, I can't complain about it. But everybody in the book was familiar to me in different ways. And everybody kind of speaks about their current situation. And it seems very dramatic and it seems full of action, but it's not really. I mean, if you consider that the book is set over about six months, but you read a book in about 4 hours or 5 hours, it's a short book, you know, it does seem too much packed. Like, people often go like, would all those things really happen in a small place like that? But of course they would. I mean, in fairness, in one day, these things can happen, yeah.
Yeah, and they happen again, and there's violence everywhere. What I found interesting, just jumping, because what's the time difference between it? When did the book, was it 2012, 2013?
2012, Spinning Heart came out, but the action, Heartbeat Peace, is around 10 years after the action in Spinning Heart.
There's a kind of a confidence about these people. So it's almost what we're talking about, Olympics and so on. It is echoed in this story as well. People have come out of the crash, and the psychology has kind of changed, hasn't it, in these characters?
Yeah, I mean, the way people see the world, I suppose, has kind of changed a bit. And Bobby Mahon is back on his feet, and he started a new company. And actually, that's one of the main reasons why I wrote the book, was because of Bobby. And the amount of people who ask me over the years, "Donal, how's Bobby? How's he getting on?" Because I didn't make it clear enough at all at the end of The Spinning Heart that Bobby was fine. And my mum worked in Tesco's for years and years, and people would queue at her till to ask her about Bobby Mahon. And they go,
"Where's Bobby Mahon?"
Yeah, and then they go through the other characters, which was great to hear. And mum always said, "Wouldn't it just be easiest for all of us if you wrote a sequel?" And she said it to me so many times over the years. I'm so sorry I didn't do it so she could read it. But it's done now anyway, thank God.
And Bobby Mahon, soundness is his big quality, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Bobby's one of these guys that people look up to and people kind of envy as well, in a way, and people want to emulate. And, you know, I mean, I put loads of my best friend and my uncles and people, you know, there's my father and strong male characters in my life into the character of Bobby. So he definitely is kind of somebody I would look up to myself.
Kind of a lovely man. And,
yeah.
And in the Spinning Heart, Facebook and kind of what was modern in those days was part of it. Now it's WhatsApp groups.
Yeah.
Is a
yeah.
big issue for poor old Bobby.
I know, poor Bobby, yeah. And I mean, these things can happen so easily. I think it's almost an age-old story about things going a bit wrong on stags and guys coming home and, you know, and people saying like, oh, you know what happens in tour stays in tour and that kind of thing, but it never does really. So Bobby is kind of a bit worried about something that's happened, and he's also taken the problems of the world on his shoulders, as he always has done. And, you know, he sees an imminent danger, a very close threat to his family in the form of the drugs trade in the area. And Bobby thinks, this is my job. You know, I've got young kids, they're at risk here. So my job as a man and as a father and as a parent is protect them.
It really struck me that that whole fear and the grimness of the 2012, that the time when the Spinning Heart is set, is the economy and the kids going abroad. Now it's like, what's going to happen to your kids who stay here because of the explosion of drugs, particularly in rural communities, where we just didn't expect it to happen, but it has.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right through this novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's happened everywhere. It's happened all over the world. And it's just because my book is set in a small place, the effect of it seems magnified. And I suppose it is in a way. But it's, I mean, it's an age-old story. Like, anywhere you go in Ireland now, you can see drug deals taking place. I saw one the other day myself, a person at the traffic lights in a car just handing drugs out through the window of their car, taking money in without even looking left or right, looking straight ahead all the time.
Yeah.
It's the most incredible thing to see.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems people can act with impunity. You know, I mean, sure, the guards are kind of hamstrung. I mean, you can't look at people sideways these days. You know, you have to be so careful. But it seems that in rural villages and towns, everyone knows who's dealing drugs. Everyone knows the car from which drugs are dealt, the house from where drugs are dealt, and it just seems to carry on and on and on. And what gets me is the way these guys walk around acting like we're all supposed to be scared of them, you know. And people are, of course they are. Mm-hmm. You know, these are dark forces at work, like, you know,
scary,
but still, yeah. They're among us, you know, they're their own people as well, which is so strange.
And Bobby Mahon isn't scared of them.
No, see, Bobby, that's the thing with Bobby, like, he's scared of nobody. But, you know, Bobby's fears all centre on his own ability to see himself as a failure. You know, I mean, he's so scared of not being the man that he thinks people think he is. Bobby's got all these things going on inside. And that's a very common thing. You know, I hate the phrase toxic masculinity because it implies that being a man inherently is toxic. But Bobby has this idea that he has to stand up, that he has to be the man that people follow. And it's kind of natural too in him. He's a natural leader.
Is there a better phrase then? Because there's masculinity, which can be a good thing. And that's what the phrase toxic masculinity is when that goes wrong.
Exactly, yeah. But the two seem to have merged now. You know what I mean? There's an awful lot of talk about it. And
rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely, yeah. You know, and I don't think it's thought about enough. I think it's kind of, it's bending about a little bit.
No one will say, God, Donald Ryan has lovely masculinity.
No, I can't hear it being said, no.
It's rarely used as a compliment, is what you mean. It starts with Bobby, and it reminded me of the seminar because it was like, I want to hear more from inside Bobby's head, what's going on. But we don't really find out really what's going on because you keep a few cliffhangers there because we don't hear from his wife until the end.
Yeah, it's the same format as Spinning Heart, so the speakers all speak in the same sequence, which made it very easy for me, to be honest. I didn't have to try too much to work out a new structure or a new form. So I just followed the voices.
Oh, a bit lazy.
Ah, yeah, sure. Look,
he's at it again.
You have to take some shortcuts.
But it does this amazing thing because it means all the action, and there is action, kind of happens in the distance because we're going to hear afterwards and what people think and say about it.
Yeah, I like that way of telling a story. It's told so the action's lens through different eyes and you see different sides of it. And the voices came very easily. I mean, they were almost clamouring. I think I left it even, you know, I should have done this book earlier because they were kind of nagging away. And the story was written in my head before I sat down to put it onto the screen. And so it was pretty easy. I mean, the voices literally, like there's one voice of Kate, I think it is. Yeah, Kate. And she, I'll forget the names. When I got to her monologue, it was as though she was saying, about time. Jesus, I'm waiting so long to tell you. And wait till you hear what happened, you know. And I literally had to type really fast to keep up with what was going on in my head. It was amazing. And I had no plan for Kate at all. Like, she just, it felt like it was being dictated. And when that happens, it's just pure magic. It's a joy.
Which one is Kate again? Can you remember?
Kate is Dennis's wife. Dennis is the man who killed Frank Mahon in The Spinning Heart.
Oh, yeah. God, there's so many characters in this. Sometimes it is...
Oh, I forget myself, yeah.
But so much happens in it. You said that it took you a while to put this in, but they kept talking to you. Your mum really wanted to see you do this book. She sadly didn't live to see it.
Yeah, so this is the first book now that mum wouldn't have read, which is sad. And she did. I mean, she asked me so many times, would you not write a sequel to The Spinning Heart? Because, you know, she was kind of mired by people going, how's Bobby getting
his job? Yeah. Yeah, his work.
And she was young, wasn't she?
She's only 71, yeah.
Really? What happened to her?
She had breast cancer.
Oh, God. Yeah. That's a terrible thing to go through with a family. Because you're still in your 40s, are you?
Yeah, I'm 48. It's a shock, all right. Yeah, I remember years ago I read an article where somebody said that when a mother dies, the centre is gone and it's very hard for a family to hold together. You know, and it does feel that way now. We're all very close, but just that kind of gravitational force of motherhood is gone, you know, and it's a strange new world, all right. But look, it comes to us all, I suppose.
And everything you knew with her in the world there, and you've got so many strong female characters in this. You must be thinking of your mammy when.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my last novel, The Queen of Earth Island, was pretty much based on mammy, even though she couldn't see it herself. Now, in fairness, because when she read the manuscript, she went, "Where did you get that one Eileen from?" She didn't see a bit of herself in the character, who was based fairly closely on mammy. In fairness, now. Well, I do. I mean, you know, I do take inspiration from mem all the time, and my grandmother and the people around me. I mean, I've been very lucky to have such great people in my life that I can use as inspiration like that.
She was like a book editor, your mam, because there's not much swearing in it.
Oh, there's not much in this one, no. And actually, I just finished a novel, actually. It's only got 3 swear words, and I didn't think I could do it, but apparently I can, so...
She hated swear.
No, she wasn't crazy about it, you know, and she was well able to swear herself now, but she didn't like me using it too much in the books. And, you know, she wasn't crazy about all my books, in fairness, no. She wasn't, and she was never fluhulak with praise. She never would praise something she wasn't impressed by. And, you know, some of them, she thought were all good, but some were better than others. So, and it does feel as though you kind of miss that approval of your mother. I mean, no matter how old you get, you still want your mother to approve what you do.
Imagine that she's reviewing it in your head.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is glad you did it.
Yeah.
And your dad is, he's gone as well.
Yeah.
God, because you're a young man, aren't you, to have both parents?
Yeah, I suppose I'm 48 now. So I suppose not that young, but, and it comes to all of us, but the world does change a lot when your parents go. And, you know, it's amazing. You have to kind of, I said in the intro there at the weekend, you kind of have to reimagine the world because, you know, we existence kind of is formed through our minds, through imagination, and you do have to kind of look at the world differently and reimagine things. And it's a very, very strange thing, all right.
I can't imagine it. Does it change the relationship you have with your kids when you lose your parents?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it really does. It does focus you on your family, I think, and those relationships and how they're so precious.
And the other important mam in your life is Anne-Marie.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Anne-Marie really is an editor. Like she doesn't admit this, but she's got such a natural talent for it. It's incredible. And thank God, I mean, I was so lucky because I do print off everything I write at the end of my writing day. And poor Anne-Marie, I don't make her, now, in fairness. She doesn't feel like she won't do it, but she does tend nearly all of us to read it.
Really?
Yeah, and she has a certain type of reaction that I look for. And if I don't see that reaction, I know it's not quite right.
Is that a non-verbal?
It can be non-verbal, yeah. You know, and it can be contained in between what she says and the interstices. You know, she mightn't necessarily say it's not great, you know, but I'll know. I'll kind of know by her tone, her expression, right? Yeah. Oh, fuck it.
There's a high right. pitch, isn't there? This is good.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God.
What, when she likes it, what are you watching out for?
Oh, I just know. I remember years ago, before I ever wrote a novel, she read a book called One Big Damn Puzzler by John Harding, an English novelist. And I read it as well. We both loved it. And I remember getting really jealous by her reaction to it. Like, really, no. I mean, it's terrible jealousy. Like, I was thinking, oh, I'd love to write something she had a reaction to someday.
And I'd love to move her like that.
Yeah, so I look for that same expression that she had when she read that novel.
And she did. She did have that reaction.
God, yeah. Oh, yeah. When I started to write the thing about December, I mean, I wrote it because I just wanted to finally have a novel finished. And of course, I plunged into writing that at the busiest time in our lives. We just got married and Anne-Marie was pregnant and I had just gotten a new job and I was working weekends and nights and we were flat out. And then I decided to take about half an hour a day to write that novel over about a year. But she loved it, you know, and the fact that she loved it meant I couldn't stop. And when I did stop around three quarters of the way through, she was just so disappointed. you know, and it's the only way to finish it. Okay. And nothing ever matched that moment, finishing that novel, writing-wise, just the sense of achievement, thinking, finally, I've finally written a book. It doesn't matter what happens now, it's just, it's done.
That's great. The thing. You dabbled in it and it becomes your life.
Yeah.
And you're now 7 novels in?
Yeah, 8 books in now and 7 novels, yeah.
Did you, 8 books, what's the...
It was the short story collection as
oh,
well.
Oh, yes, yeah. Very good. And there's also a novel that was never published.
It's a couple, actually, yeah. And actually,
when you finished,
because it was when I wrote without any involvement from Anne-Marie, so that could be the problem, because she was sick at the time. She was in recovery from cancer, and she wasn't reading the form for reading my rubbish every day. Yeah. So she said, "Look, I trust you. This is your 6th book. You know, how far on can you go? So I'll wait till the end." Big mistake.
You never read it.
Very far wrong, yeah.
Because you wrote about this, didn't you? I read that essay that you did where you go out on to the silver mines. Is it
right,
in your dad's car?
Yeah, it's a old car. MGB that I inherited. And so I go up to Tapkeeper Hill to celebrate. Just, it's a silly thing, you know. just kind of, it's kind of a ritual now at this stage when I finish a book, The Climb Keeper. And I kind of knew that day, Climbing Keeper, that book will never see the light of day. I kind of knew, you know. And it had gone off to my editor and publisher, and I kind of expected them to be circumspect in politics as always, but to kind of say it's not really working as a novel. I kind of knew, it's strange, you know. On the one hand, I was thinking, oh, it's my best book ever. And on the other hand, I was thinking, it doesn't really quite work.
What's it like to have spent that amount of time and effort on something and realise?
Oh, it was totally fine, Oliver, honest to God, because you have to make these mistakes, you know. I do think that. I think every writer has these manuscripts in their closet that never will be published, but still will have taught them a lot about themselves as writers.
I see what you mean. So you kind of have to write something that's not going to work to get to the good stuff.
Absolutely, I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Scrape it away. Anne-Marie's okay now. She had two brushes with cancer, did she?
She did, yeah. She cervical cancer about 12 years ago and breast cancer a few years ago as well. But she's great now, thank God, yeah. She's very strong and she's in great form.
And the most important reader. Because she works in the... It's a family business now, isn't it?
It is pretty much, yeah. She's my editor and my first editor, really. I mean, my editor's Brian Langan, but Anne-Marie, you know, before something goes to Brian, it's to go to Anne-Marie, and Brian knows that. But she's also my manager and an agent, which is great.
So you're chatting books and reading the whole time?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, you get a lot of books sent to you in the post when you're published. So there's never a shortage. And yeah, she's a great reader as well.
Yeah. But not a writer herself?
No, not yet anyway.
Not yet?
She's no real inclination, in fairness, though.
There's time, plenty of time. Mm-hmm. And your two kids, are they teenagers now?
Yeah, Thomas is 16 and Lucy's 14. They're not too impressed by me at all, you know, as a writer, but hopefully they are as a father. But which means for them, it's just always been there. Like, it's just always been a thing in the family. So it's no big deal at all.
Are they readers, or what are they interested in?
Lucy's a big reader, I write. Thomas, not so much these days now. He's more into soccer and women, but...
that's Curtis, yeah. That. Soccer and women. But that's good masculinity. Just to
it is. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To reiterate. Yeah. I'd say there's a fear of leaving CERT. Is there your book coming up?
Yeah, you see, The Spinning Heart was on the syllabus for a good while, and it was actually on the prescribed syllabus for a while, so it was almost unavoidable. But it's taken off that now, and so he reckons he's going to avoid it. But you never know. Things could change this year.
It pops up, doesn't it?
Yes. It does, yeah, because so things can go back on again, you know.
I'd say writers love when their books appear in the Leaving Cert.
Oh, it's brilliant. There's nothing like it. I remember years ago, I had a teacher called Martin Slattery for Leaving Cert English. He was a brilliant teacher. And he said, lads, in 50 years' time, one E could be on the Leaving Cert. And so I bet that by factor about 5, I think, because, yeah. Which is great. I still talk to Martin every now and again. He was a great teacher.
There's a couple of messages coming through. I read The Spinning Heart when it first came out. I still think of the chapter with the nurse in the nursing home. See, you love hearing that, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
that kind of thing, moving them. My grandmother, Molly Ryan Cooper, lived in Kilmistulla beside the lay-by. We used to visit every Sunday, and all my granny used to say was, keep in off the road, the Shearies are coming.
Sounds right.
The Shearies are wild drivers who were Donal's uncles.
That's right.
Allegedly. Yeah, yeah. Allegedly.
And they haven't changed.
That's from Christine Finnerty.
Hi, Christine. How are you doing?
Do you know all the Finnerty? Do you know the Finnerty's?
Of course.
Good. Congratulations on the publication of the new book, Heartbeat at Peace. Donal is one of life's gentlemen. He was my tutor in Limerick a couple of years ago. Please pass all my best wishes. That's from Pat Griffin.
Hey, Pat. How are you doing?
And you're still a tutor, by the way, aren't you?
I am, absolutely.
The proper term.
Yeah,
where exactly?
I lecture in creative writing and the MA at UL, and it's great. It's brilliant just to have it, you know, just to have the job, basically. But it's just such a joy to be involved with writers every day of my working life. and to have such great colleagues. Actually, I just got a proof copy of Fee Scarlett's new book, Fee's Teaching Matters in You Well, May All Your Skies Be Blue. Beautiful title. So it'll be out in the autumn, I think.
Oh, lovely. So you're reading away all the time. Yeah. Encouraging. And so you're still technically a civil servant, despite your attempts.
I suppose, yeah. I never think of it that way, but I suppose you could say that. Yeah. Yeah.
Because your career was varied. It was workplace relations.
I was there, yeah. And I was in the vehicle registration unit in Shannon for years and years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I loved it. I loved those jobs, to be honest. Yeah.
Those people always answer the phone. I like those people down in.
Oh, we're great in Shannon. Absolutely, yeah. Best office in the country.
Like people go, you can't get hold of anyone in these. Ring Shannon. They'll be straight on to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll find out about the Shearies and how they drive in the area.
From the North, text studio, followed by your message to 80889.
She's such a lovable champion, and the trip there has not been the easiest for her. Women's boxing, I was reading, has only been at the Olympics since 2012. That's when Katie Taylor won gold, remember, in London, and the attention and the favour was only on Katie. But even she couldn't win back-to-back golds. Kelly has come out of the shadow. She has surpassed the silhouette and has become the greatest of all time. But first and foremost, for her, she's a wife, a sister, she's a daughter. She loves her job at St. Vincent's. It's a psychiatric hospital in Fairview in Dublin. And when she came in to chat to us here in May, only a couple of months ago, she was talking about her plans to retire. They were well known. She said, as soon as these Olympics are over, I'm going to retire. And we asked her then what she wanted for her future. Here she is back then.
Well, I'm still employed, but I haven't been there now in, since January, I'd say. I stopped at the end of January just so I could focus
for
on training.
Reasons, yeah. But they're very good, yeah.
As soon as I'm out of the Olympics, like, I'm going straight back to work. That's what I want to do. I just crave normality. I'm not flashy. I just want the simple little things in life, and I want to be able to look after me family and my extended family, and just to do little things in my community for people who need it, you know. That's all I want. Like, I don't, like, I'm not asking for much.
There's that laugh again. And after the fight, later in the night, when the sing-songs and everything had kind of died down a bit and there was a bit of calm, she did clarify she's only 98% certain that she is going to retire from boxing. I was looking at her book yesterday, and a fantastic book, by the way. It's simply called Kelly, the one with Roddy Doyle. A brilliant, superb memoir of her life up to Tokyo 3 years ago when she won the first gold. And it's wonderfully written because you feel you're with Kelly between every page. And there may well be an update to the book, but she said all she wanted to do after winning that first medal in Tokyo, she just wanted to chat to Mandy, talk to her Amanda, and get a Big Mac and a milkshake. She just loves that simple life at home with the missus and the dogs. They absolutely love their dogs. And as Kelly was chatting to us when she came in, she's someone who walks around her beloved inner city of Dublin. But she is now, however, she's a double champion on the biggest sporting stage that there is. And she will be in exceptional demand. There will no doubt be life-changing offers made. She'll be a brilliant ambassador just for sport in general and boxing, touring the country, doing speeches, because she has the verve and the vim. But it is extraordinary. And what this means for her family is something else, because the dedication and the amount of sacrifice and time that goes into it all. Well, let's find out again, because Kelly is one of four siblings. She has three brothers, Christopher, Aaron and Joel, with under the parents Yvonne and Christy. Christopher is on the line live from Paris. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning.
How are you? You must be still on a high.
Yeah, absolutely. Just listening to you talk about our last interview when she was in with you in May is bringing a tear to me. Oh, just so happy just to hear it, because it's a massive testament to my mother and father and the job they've done, not only raising Kelly, but all of us. And that's the fruition of everything. It's beautiful.
You're so close as a family. It's gorgeous to see. And I love hearing you all talk about each other.
Yeah, you have to be. We had no choice. I mean, we were raised by two great parents who tried to give us everything we ever had in life. And I think the drive and the work rate and the desire to succeed for Kelly, just seeing me da every morning up at 4 o'clock, drinking his coffee before he's cycling to Rathfarnham and out to Premier Dairies or Finglas or wherever it was, and coming home and putting his wages on the table there at the end of the week, just so my ma and his kids could have something to eat and to provide for us. And all of that, like, we seen that growing up as kids, and you're unconsciously taking it in and learning the value of hard work and what it takes to succeed in life without even knowing it, you know. And I can't be any happier for my ma and dad, because I know how proud they are and what it means to them. And I spoke to my ma a few minutes ago, and she can't stop crying.
I think half the country is crying. You're going to have us at it again, Christopher. I mean, it is unbelievable, isn't it? What a story, you and your family, from Portland Row and to the biggest stage of them all in the entire world. And to do it twice is just, it's incredible. I don't know what it's like to be so close to this woman.
Yeah, and I think Kelly said it yesterday in one of the interviews with RTE, I think it was. Obviously, winning anything once at a high level is very, very tough. But to come back and to have that carrot on your head and do it again, given the circumstances that she's been through the last year, makes it even more special. And she referenced a lot of times last night that she did it for her, and rightly so, because what she's gone through the last year has been tough. And again, for me, seeing her coming out with a gold medal, and knowing everything that has been put on her, that's remarkable. There's not many people in the world of sport, I don't think, that could have a single-mindedness and a focus. And again, it's credit to the people around, to Mandy, to my ma and dad, and everybody that's close to our coaches. So massive testament to what they've done.
I don't think it's kind of known enough how tough the last year has been on Kelly and Mandy and the whole lot of you. And I met Mandy only a couple of months ago, and she just talked about how Kelly just wasn't really herself in the last year. And it was just a media controversy, wasn't it? Which is well forgotten now, but just to come from that is unbelievable.
Yeah, of course. I mean, when you're in the spotlight as an athlete or any type of, if there's any type of, you're renowned or whatever, it's always tough when you get things said about you or harsh criticism or whatever it may be. And regardless of who you are or what you are, we're human beings and we have feelings. And Kelly's definitely got them. And yeah, the last year has been very, very tough for her and also for me, ma and dad. And to see last night what happened is, like I said earlier on and many times, I'm just so happy for my man and dad, because this was massive. And again, it shows that they've done an unbelievable job in raising a lady that is, and that's what she is. Like, that's what Kelly is. She's an absolute gem, and everyone knows it.
She's a brilliant person. We didn't doubt her. Very intelligent as a boxer, but she's very emotionally intelligent too.
Yeah, she is. I wouldn't emotionally intelligent. Yeah, I don't know if I'd coin it that. I'd just say she speaks from her heart, and whether the emotional intelligence comes from that or not, she speaks with authenticity and what she's feeling, and she'll never lead anyone wrong. She's always trying to look for the best in people and to help. And again, I come back to my ma and that. She doesn't get that from anywhere. It's what she's been brought up in and how she's been raised. And it's to see last night in Roland Garros, in one of the most iconic stadiums in the world, really, definitely in tennis, to see the following she had there, it was, I can't even put a term on it, because I'm still trying to come to reality of what I actually seen last night.
Did you manage to enjoy that atmosphere, the incredible build-up in Roland Garros, or were you terrified, nervous?
It was a bit of both, to be honest with you. We got to the stadium fairly early, actually. So we had, I think it was about 6 or 7 fights before Kelly. So we settled in okay. Like, and then, obviously the fight before, myself and Mandy were doing laps of Roland Garros, so we were trying to get the jitters out, but a bit of both, really.
That was outside, running around. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, we were walking around, like just getting them out before we went in for the flight. But again, when you see her walk out and you see the team behind Kelly, it's what a team, the coaching staff that they have there. And I think all throughout the tournament, just myself as a coach, I told Kelly after our last fight, I'm so proud of her as a coach, to see her execute what our coaches have asked her to do, and for her to live up to it and put into play what they've asked to do, and just to follow instruction. For me as a coach, saying that, it's that makes me so proud, you know, and carrying out the demands that they put on her. But they deserve an awful lot of credit. Like, they are unbelievable coaches, and I think the main part is the human connection. As human beings, you don't get better, and you seen it last night. They were united as a team, and I think once I seen them walk out, it was going to be hard for anyone to beat Kelly.
And I mean, the very first thing she does is thank her coaches. The fight delayed very late. We saw her in the zone, and it was nerve wracking for the whole country watching her, because she was there on her own, reading that note in her hand to herself over and over again. Everybody's dying to know what's in the note.
Yeah, no, it's, they're the moments, obviously. I'm sure that everyone, I'm not sure what the pictures are like on OTA, but in the stadium in Roland Garros, you could see it on the screen, because she was behind where the fighters walk out. So yeah, it was a nervous couple of minutes, but as soon as she comes out and you see the walk and you see the team behind her, it's that for me, that's a feeling of excitement and just ready to go. And also, again, I reference it, just how united the coaches and Kelly are. It's special. Very, very special.
We could see it. Now, the excitement is going to be, there's going to be a major homecoming and lots of celebrating. But the questions are about the retirement plans. And she has discussed and kind of announced these things at length, hasn't she? She plans to go back to her life and back to her family.
Yeah, I mean, again, you said it earlier on, like Kelly, she just wants to get home to the dogs and have a cup of tea.
Up to Nidge. And ma, it's one of the dogs.
Yeah, exactly. And my ma will be delighted as well, because she's had to be minding the two dogs the last 2 weeks. So she's up the wall with four dogs, you know? She'd be delighted to get rid of two of them. But I think everyone that knows Kelly, that's all she wants to do. She wants to go home, hug the dogs, hug me ma, hug me there, and enjoy a cup of tea, a cake, whatever, and just get on with life.
There'll be one hell of a homecoming in the meantime, in between. I couldn't let you go, by the way, Christopher Harrington, without asking you about, you're a football coach, aren't you? Soccer coach, and you spent time in Iceland. That's what you do.
Yeah, I'm not in Iceland at the moment. I finished up in Iceland. I was in Iceland for 7 years, and I'm actually over in America now. I'm over there now. Been there for the last
as a coach.
Nearly 2 years. Yeah, as a coach.
Wow. Just an incredible success. So you probably know our new Irish manager then, the Icelandic.
Yeah, I do, Jaime. So, looking forward to what he can do. And hopefully we can have more nights like last night with the Irish football team.
Yeah, that would be something else. It's a big ask. That's Jaime, is what you call him. Hal Grimson. He's there. Then you manager, which you get used to saying
right.
That. Christopher, you go and enjoy yourself in Paris. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate the chat.
Thanks a million.
And congratulations to you and your whole family. That's Christopher.
Yeah, thanks a million.
There. Thanks a million. Thanks so much. And we'll let Christopher go there. What an absolute, they're an incredible family. They're able to speak poetry at a moment's notice, live on the radio after some of those incredible scenes. So there you go, kneecap wrapping, drugs and tip, and a doting brother. Sure, where else would you get it? It's the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you. Farewell. Agus slán.
0818 715 925. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.